Hi, it's Craig Wilson here, and welcome to the latest episode of the Making the Media podcast. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us. It's great to have you here. This time, we're heading to the United Arab Emirates to speak to our latest guest, who is Dina Niemer. Dina is the head of media operations for the Al Arabiya Media Network, and she's based in Dubai. Al Arabiya is part of the NBC Group, and the group is in the process of relocating some of their operations to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. Dina's heavily involved in the transition, and that forms part of our discussion as we look at change management, delegation, technology, championing women in the media, and we also get her thoughts on the use of AI. But we started by discussing her background and her career path so far.
Originally, I studied both computer science and mass communication broadcasting for university, and then I had a passion for writing. So I was interning as a reporter during university time, and then I did part of my graduation project was actually about Al Arabiya's launch in 2003. So that's how I got to meet the people in Al Arabiya, and it was a dream for me to actually join the company, and that's how I started off here. After graduation, I reached out, I got an opportunity to intern, and I started off with the editorial side because that's what I'm passionate about. So I can say I'm a journalist at heart. And that was very important, actually starting my career in the editorial section as a researcher, reporting, producing, all that from the editorial side was important. And then the big move came when everyone thought, oh, she knows a lot about computers. That's how they assume, you know, and that you know about these things. And then My ex-boss, who is someone I look up to and I admire a lot, she believed in me, and she actually pushed me to change that role into a technical role. And then from there, I moved into media management and project management in the company, and moving to work more with the technical teams. So I would say I'm a journalist at heart, but I'm literally the link between engineering and editorial. And then I moved to international operations for managing all the connectivity and the operations of our international offices. And then from that, I moved to be head of media operations now, which is basically, I do whatever comes my way. but it does require leading some teams like the media management team, the librarians teams, as well as working on projects, managing projects, working on our international relations with our suppliers and the commercial contracts. But yeah, whatever comes my way, I'm happy. I'm happy to do it. It's all about operations. So that's how my role has evolved.
So Dina, let's pick up on something you mentioned there. You said you're a journalist at heart, and you talked about your journalist background. But you are now, you know, in a technical role. But how do you feel that sort of operational experience that you have helps you with the role that you have now?
Oh, it's everything. It's why I am actually in my position now, because you understand the users. If you're not one, I tell them I'm one of you. I'm like, I go to the end users, I'm telling them I'm one of you. I understand how important it is for you to press on that button to move one frame forward for you to actually be able to edit. You know, you have these little examples from your own experience where you actually relate to the users, where, and then you can really try to explain to the engineering or the technical people how important these things are to the end users. And then you try to link between both and try to make each team understand the importance of that item or that change or that feature request to the other team. So if I'm here today, it's because of actually being able to understand both worlds, let's put it that way.
And I think as well, another aspect of that is when it comes to perhaps implementing change, you're able to understand both sides of the coin, if you like. So I know that at Arabiya, and we'll talk about this in a little while, that there's lots of change going on, there's lots of, you know, moves happening and things like that. So how does that impact, you know, how your approach to what you're doing?
Okay. Again, that's very fundamental, because the one thing I know for a fact, and we all know, although we don't like to admit it, is that change is the only constant. Yet to apply change, I think I'm quoting Steve Jobs here when he said that a manager convinces people to apply the change, but a leader actually motivates them to apply that change. And if you don't understand your end users, you don't understand their needs, you don't understand why they need to evolve, if you don't not only sit and convince them, even with our latest upgrade, I had the people actually come to me and say, when are we going to upgrade? You've told us, you've showed us these features. When is it actually happening? So you have to actually try to convince the users that they want to actually do this change. And what's most important, in my opinion, in change is, of course, you know, there is always a theory of the carrot or the stick, but I don't look at it at neither the carrot or the stick. It's about making your own meal. That's how you look at it. So when we look at the teams, first of all, I listen to them. I see what are their needs, what they wish to see, what are their problems. And then we talk to the companies who actually have these products or whatever the companies or the teams that actually work on developing whatever the end users need. And then we try to explain to them and we take our time. Honestly, as us, we always take sometimes a little bit of our sweet time, but the most important thing is that we actually reach the goal that we want. So we divide the people into teams and I get them to actually talk. I get them to try. I get them to test. And then when you give them accountability, when you give them responsibility of everything, of the bits and pieces of the project, and when you are sure that they are involved in each bit of it, then that's when you get them on board and they're the ones on your, they're on your side. And then they're the ones asking for that change to happen.
Is it fair to say then that, you know, change management is a sort of fundamental aspect of any technology change?
It is essential, it's fundamental, and as I said, it's constant. And the way I see it moving forward for any company, that change shouldn't be something that we apply every now and then when a new like product comes along. Actually, it should be systematic. That's the way I should. It's just a change has to be systematic for any company to be able to evolve and to do better and to attract its target audience.
And change is something, as you said, is constant within the industry. You know, that's one thing that you and I both know and recognize. So what from your own perspective have been the biggest changes which have benefited users over the course of maybe the last five or 10 years?
Let's say if we go back like 10 years, I remember the biggest change was actually going tapeless. So I do remember how you couldn't convince a producer that he has to get rid of the tapes. And then you'd walk around and I'd have, actually, personally, I'd see producers hiding the tapes under their desk or in their drawers. And then I actually had one incident where I'm actually pulling the tape. I'm saying, it's there. It's on the system. It's digitized. It's okay. Just give it to me. Just hand it in. So that was like the biggest change, that people always like to have something tangible in their hands, you know, something they can see, something they can hold on. Until now, we still struggle with that, and it takes time to actually see the change happen. And then you go back to them, and I always tell them, please just give me a couple of weeks or give me a month and I'll come back and I will ask you. And I do go back and I ask them, because after any change there's always a snagging, whether it's a system change or organizational change, there is always some snagging and getting used to whatever the change was. And then I believe that stage is also very, very, very important for getting the people's trust in that change.
One other thing that you mentioned earlier on, Dina, when you were describing your role, is it's clear that you work with a whole variety of different teams. And your role is very broad. It covers lots of different aspects. So you're only one person. It's impossible for you to do everything. So how do you work within those own team to perhaps delegate to make sure you get the right result? How does that work at your company?
Yes. Well, I am not one person. As a Dina, I'm a one person, but I have a zillion arms that support me. And if it wasn't for the team, nothing would be done, if it wasn't for every single one of them. And seriously, delegation, I honestly, even at home, I like to do things myself. I say, okay, the only way to make sure, I'm a perfectionist, so I have to do it myself and do it all over again. And it took me time when I first got my first manager role. I remember someone told me, a good manager knows how to delegate. You need to do that, or you will be able to do it if you do everything yourself for the first week, for the second week, and then after that, you'll start sinking. So that's when I started to learn. But then I go like, but people sometimes do mistakes. And then I learned that's how you actually learn. You give the people the tools, and sometimes they need extra additional tools. And then you You let them fail, because actually sometimes failures are the best success you have. It's when you actually do that failure and how you can actually turn that failure into a success story, that actually sometimes you go like, wow, that actually that person has actually done additional well. And sometimes you actually realize that there are things that were missing in workflows, for example, that you didn't realize if it wasn't for that for that failure. So you do need to delegate, you need to trust the people, you need to empower them, and that source of responsibility motivates them to actually try to do better at the job, and to try to support their managers and their teams.
How do you feel that you have grown as a person because of the different roles that you've had? I mean, it's really interesting what you said there about, you know, you see yourself as a perfectionist, and you know, you would be the one who'd want to do things. But clearly you yourself have had to learn and develop in your own career. So how do you think it's changed your approach to things?
Okay, so I have like, okay, I still want to do things myself, and I still get assigned I assign myself tasks, no matter how big or no matter how small. For example, now we're end of some digitization project, and I told them, please, the last packing of that last tapes box, I want to do myself. I want to go down and do the packing myself. I want to be part of anything anyone does. So I always try to make sure, maybe every month, that there are things that I get to do myself with the team, and able to understand them and to understand their workflows and understand the changes that they go through. Honestly, I've changed a lot because also part of the way we do things here is that, for example, I had a manager who believed in me, and who she pushed me to actually take on my role. And this is what I'm actually looking for for the future, as looking at how to empower others as well. And so recently, just a year ago, we've also started Women Empowerment at Work initiative that I'm proud to represent Al Arabiya as part of MBC of that initiative. And we've started doing some leadership and mentorship speakers. We bring them abroad, and we start to take that on board in order to improve also the female participation and the female empowerment at work. So something that I will be looking at the future. And this quote, my best friend told me that, who works in communication, she always says that women are over mentored but under sponsored, which means that in the future, what I would like to see, that's something I wish I can work on, is not only finding someone to talk to or to mentor you or to give you advice, but actually someone to sponsor you at work, someone who believes in you and your task, someone who you need support. He actually helps you and paves the way, or she paves the way for you to actually get to achieve what. This is something I still need to work on, and I'm looking forward to work on for the future.
Yeah, that's a great initiative, Dina. That's really, really great to hear. So let's move on to talking about another aspect of your role. So MBC, part of Al Arabiya, in the process of moving from Dubai to new operations in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. So tell us a bit about that move.
This is our biggest project. This is our biggest move. So Al Arabiya was launched in Dubai on the 3rd of March 2003. And the new decision was to actually move the headquarters from Dubai to Saudi Arabia, which is a great move, especially with the changes. What's something that people don't know about me, I was actually born and raised in Saudi till the end of high school. And just myself going there and seeing the changes that has happened across the kingdom, it's just amazing, the opportunities, the work opportunities, and the relationships that are actually being built on all the sides, on the media industry and infrastructure, technology, on all aspects. It's quite amazing. So we are proud to be part of that change, and we have started, I would say, surely but slowly. So what we actually did so far is our breaking news channel, which is Al Hadath channel, has officially completely moved by the end of 2003. It's fully relocated to Saudi Arabia for Al Arabiya News. Now we have over about 8 to 10 hours bulletins that are actually coming out of there, and we're in the process that we just need time for the infrastructure to be ready for everyone's move to happen now within a year or two, I hope. But yes, it's something I'm looking forward to, and it's something that we're actually proud of being part of that amazing change that's happening over there. I know it's not easy, Now coming to my role, that puts a lot of difficulties for me.
So what kind of challenges would it pose having two different sites? Because as an organization, you want to have good communication between the different sites. You want them to be able to share, media and stories and things like that. So how does that work in practical terms?
Okay, I remember when we first, myself and the engineering manager, when we first heard about this change, we were like, oh my God, what are we going to do? It's not going to work. It's not going to work. It's just not going to work. But then I also learned that always, you always start, you need to start. I was like reluctant to change myself. And then I was like, no, you put the ends at the end. So I was like, what's the end result? The end result, you have both sides, they're connected and they're in sync and everything is going in between smoothly. How to reach that? Then we started going backwards. So we've come a long, long, long way. I wouldn't say it was very easy, but we had a lot of support also by the companies, and we had to that support us on all our sy the systems we use. And we're doing it gradually. So currently, for example, we put workflows in place where we have two sites, and all the media comes here and comes there as well. So all the incoming media, and then whatever is actually produced gets sent to both galleries. So we have all the output actually gets sent here and gets sent in Dubai and gets sent to Saudi and vice versa. So it creates a lot of media, and honestly, so far the workflows have been put in place are very useful. We've added some also options to support our social media, such as the publisher. We've had to do a lot of additions, and we've had to even explain to our suppliers how come we want it's the same content, but we're using it here and there because of course it has some commercial impact. But yeah, it has been a long road, but we're getting there. We still have some internet connectivity issues between the sites, but whatever, we're working on it little by little. And now, yes, we officially have two sites that are working in sync with news being produced here and there, where each site can see the other site's content, which is really amazing. Like 2 years ago, I thought that's impossible.
Yes, I mean, so how does the sort of technology that you've applied, and maybe talk a little bit about that, how does that help in terms of, that sharing of content between the different sites?
It's important because, for example, a producer sitting here, talking to a producer sitting in Riyadh, well, he would just say, oh, I'm using story XYZ. Then the other producer needs to log in and see the story XYZ, and then they can work on the same story simultaneously, and each on his own site, and then whenever he's done, he can actually do a send to playback and send it to the gallery here or there. So it's very important that both can see the same thing. So there are some times when we get complaints from our top users, we go like, why did this Reuters story come here 2 minutes before the other site there, where we cannot explain such examples. But it's very important, and I'm actually proud of how far supportive even the editorial team were. And they went through the whole process, they accepted the change. Sometimes it does currently for multi-sites create some sort of an extra load on all of the employees, technical and editorial as well, to sometimes need to work here and there. But it just takes some time to grasp logging into here or logging into there and being able to share the stories between sites. But I think maybe many other TV organizations who have live production from other countries as well already have that multi-site business model. But yeah, it was great that we got to apply it here.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting example again of the things that we've talked about before about change management being both a technical thing and also a people business. The two things come hand in hand. One other aspect that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, Dina, is one subject that's unavoidable at the moment within the industry is talking about AI. There's a lot of talk about it. There's a lot of excitement about it as well. I'm just wondering what the view is from where you sit within the Middle East. What your own view of it, and what kind of exploration are you doing about AI at the moment?
Okay, so us coming from the Middle East, a lot of the time we always think, oh, are we're far behind, you know, the folks in the States or in Europe, because, you know, we're in the Middle East and it takes us more time to apply the technology. But that actually, that's not true when it comes to AI. There are, the way I look at AI, just like so I can explain the differences, in is that there are two types of AI. There's AI that's applied to operations, the efficiencies, the workflows related to the production of content. And there is the generative AI that's related to the editorial content itself. And there is a big, big difference of how we actually look at both. So anything related to operations and efficiencies, such as, for example, translation, the dubbing, the segmentation of video content, all these things, we're always happy. We're always happy to look into it and how we can actually apply it across the news or the operations departments working on all these segments for the news. And then there is the other part, which is the content generative AI, which this one we are very cautious about how we will deal with it, because again, we're a news channel, we deal with news and politics, and our core strengths, our core value is our slogan is actually closer to the truth. So if we cannot play with anything that would touch our credibility, so we have to be very careful about how we actually approach it. So here it wasn't about having the first mover's advantage. It's not about that. It's about how you actually apply it right to a way that suits your needs. So what we are doing, we're still experimenting, and I know that we're not the only one who are still experimenting, many other channels as well. And the reason I know this, because for example, we are part of the AIB, which is Association of International Broadcasters. They have formed a committee that actually discusses AI across the different four TV broadcasters. Okay, so, and we have different channels from all over the world, from the States to Singapore, who are part of this initiative, and we meet regularly, and we're starting to discuss this. What can we do about it? Do we need to apply a rule? We're trying to share our experiences on who is using what, and should we do this or shouldn't we do that? So yes, we all sort of agree that yes, we need to apply it when it comes to anything on technical products or tools, but still no one tells you which tool to use. It's still all news. It's all new. For me, of course, I'm looking for a tool, even for Avid, for example. You have Avid Ada that's yet, where we were very happy that there is an Ada, but it's yet to actually be implemented. For example, some of the examples you use is how you can tell Ada, for example, that you want her to create a sequence of the funny segments of a video, and then Ada would just choose that and do it for you. But then when it comes to content, the rule is the humans, it should always have the control and have the final say on anything that gets created. And then there are other examples. What rules should we put if anything was created with the use of that content? Does it have to be watermarked even on screen to say that this content was created with the help of card? But then would that make us lose credibility or not? There are so many questions there. And that's one side. And then the other side would be, what about the content we are receiving? Is it credible? Is there a tool that would tell you this photo was AI or this footage was AI generated or it's actually original? We are looking for such tools for the future, and we talk. We're always happy to share any experience we have with others, and we want to gain experience from others as well. To know more about it. For example, I just came from a trip to the European Parliament, and I was very happy to know that they are actually launching between February and April, they're launching the AI Act, which is an act that needs that will come in place. They will give 12 months for the companies to comply with it, that will actually set rules. They will actually divide AI into categories of risk, of low and high or medium, and they will have some rules there that us as organizations can follow and can comply with. So it's all work in progress. We want to benefit from it as much as possible. We still experimenting with which tools to use, which tools not to use, but we're always extremely cautious when it comes to anything related to content generation, especially that we work in news and politics.
Yeah, you mentioned Avid Ada there. So for anyone who doesn't know, go to avid.com/ada you can find out a lot more about the kind of work that we're doing around the use of AI. And an important aspect for us is about responsible AI. You know, that really is how, you know, the approach that Avid's taking to it. We very much want the human, the journalist or the editor, to be the one that has the ultimate decision about what's being used. But it is a very, you know, interesting area at the moment. And I want to just ask one other question there. You mentioned about the kind of international groups that you're part of. Do you see different approaches from those groups? You mentioned there's people from the States, there's people from Europe, people from Asia that's in it, or is there more a sort of coalescing around it? We have the same kind of broad concerns or broad excitement about what AI can mean.
We're all excited. Like what I was telling them actually is like AI is the new internet. It's as if the internet came and then we're going to see how it is and how it will be in the future. But as I said, this one does not have a first mover's advantage. It's just about how you apply it correctly. All of us are excited, but all of us are concerned. And that's why we've gathered together. Like, this is from what I see, whether companies in the AIB or companies or broadcasters, part of the news exchange, for example. We all want to learn from each other. But I've seen some different approaches where some are looking for a tool to actually apply. And some have actually tried to develop their own. So there is one channel I can think of that actually has, they've shown us a video of how they have actually made a tool that takes the sequences out of their editing system. And then it actually explains and generates the text out of that sequence. It makes it into a text. So, and that was internally developed. So yeah, there are different approaches. Those who are cautious are still looking around. Some have started to develop their own and some have started buying some softwares to help them, for example, like specifically when it comes to, it's easy to apply when it comes to translation and dubbing and so on. And some, like for us, for example, we've applied it, for example, not when the news content, but for example, if you want to look up, we have a bot you can talk to that looks up the policies for you. So I don't have to look for any policy. I can just ask the bot and it will find it and get it out for me out of the HR policies or the legal policies or so on. So each company, all of the companies share the same thing. We're all excited, but then we don't know how to really approach. For me, all I want is, I don't want to confuse the users. I don't want them to start testing with so many different, at least super users, yes, can test. But all the users, if you want to apply something across, I wish I would have a tool within my tools. You know, it's already hard for the users that they have to open, like, for example, Word and all these different applications for the different softwares. I don't want additional ones, one for the translation, and then they have to take that and export it and take it into another program and so on. I wish I could have one go-to item, you know, that... or the APIs would allow it to integrate with our existing production systems, for example, like Avid or so on, where it can actually be a tab within your application that you can actually try to have a chatbot to ask about content background and another chatbot that does the translation and so on within your own. That's something we will be looking for the future, hopefully.
Yeah, it's a very exciting area. There's no doubt about it, Dina. It's interesting how you describe it as like the new internet. You know, I think it's very, very interesting. And I think it's an area that, you know, there's going to be huge amounts of development around. And I think you've highlighted all of the things that people talk about, the caution of it, where it's one thing where if you want to take advantage of it for technical reasons, but when it comes to content creation, content generation, you have to be very, very careful about how it's applying. And it's really interesting to hear your views on that. So Dina, it's great to catch up with you. It's lovely to have a chat again. One thing is a final question I ask everyone on the podcast. So I will ask you, which is, what is it, if anything, that keeps you up at night?
I sleep like a log, honestly. I'm a morning person, so I always make sure, I know people don't believe that, but I actually do get 8 to 9 hours of sleep daily. But no, I'll tell you what keeps me up at night. Avid upgrades keep me up. Why do you always do the upgrade at night? No, the only when we have upgrades, that's when I stay at night, when it's work-related. Also, I only stay up at night when I'm worried about one of our reporters covering something in the political unrest that's there now in the region. worrying about their safety, making sure that they reached the safe zone or the report is out. And that's another thing that worries me or keeps me up at night sometimes. And at home, oh my God, I have got two boys. And yes, so I can stay up at night trying to convince them that they should go to sleep before I do. Yeah.
Thanks a lot to Dina for joining us on the podcast and covering so many different aspects of her role within the organisation. What do you think of what she had to say? Remember to get in touch via any of the Avid social channels, or you can email us. We are makingthemedia@avid.com. And don't forget to like, review and share the podcast with friends and colleagues. Check out the show notes, where you can find links to recent articles on the work which Avid is doing in the world of AI, sharing our thoughts with others in the industry. And there's also a link to a recent webinar, where you can hear from leading industry figures discussing the benefits of the Avid Community Association and how to get involved. That's all for this episode. Thanks again to Dina, to our producer Matt Diggs, and most of all, to you for listening. I'm Craig Wilson. Join us next time for more of the people making the media.